Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. Keith Pannell here with Russ Chinelli. And today we have a guest who's going to be talking to us a little bit about the nature of a field of chemistry called analytical chemistry. That is, how do we use what we know about science to sort of investigate what's on surfaces or what we would like to see on surfaces, et cetera, et cetera. And Russ, who's our guest?
We're very happy to have with us on Science Studio this time Professor Mary Wirth. She's from the chemistry department at Purdue University. Welcome to Science Studio, Mary.
Well, thank you very much.
Before we get into, you know, what it is you're an expert in, and you're an American Chemical Society Award winner, actually. I should have mentioned that. You won the ACS Award for Analytical Chemistry in 2006. So you know what you're talking about. But before we get into that, how did you get into this game? What made you become a scientist when you were a young girl?
When I was very small, my father is an amateur scientist. He's still living. He's 85 years old. And he loves science. He never went to college, but he does all of the sorts of things that you can do without a college degree. So he likes to watch the Discovery Channel. And when I was a kid, there was educational television, and he would watch that with us. We'd sit on his lap. And he would take us out fossil hunting and all sorts of things. And when I was about 4 years old, my dad had a telescope. And he would take it out of the closet and put it in the front yard, and he would look at the stars and the planets and everything. And we lived, as I would describe it, on the wrong side of Jefferson Street. It was a working-class neighborhood, in Joliet, Illinois. We didn't have a lot of money. Nobody in our neighborhood did, so it was not a very pretty neighborhood to live in. And I was watching my dad looking through this telescope, and I went out in the front yard, and I wanted to look through. And so he lifted me up. And I looked through the eyepiece, and there was Saturn with all these beautiful rings. And I thought, wow, I never imagined right there in our neighborhood something so beautiful as Saturn. Then I started to notice, as he took us rock hunting and all of that, that you could walk out into the street when they just put gravel on the street, and you could find quartz and all kinds of beautiful rocks. And with science, I realized that no matter what your surroundings look like, there's all this beauty around you if you know what you're looking for and if you understand it. And I was hooked at that point.
So why chemistry, not physics or astronomy or math or whatever?
That's another interesting question. So I like all sciences. I could have gone into any of them. I could have gone into any field. You know, I always have found everything interesting. When I was 14, my dad was talking to my oldest brother about careers. And he said, the way that you find a career is that you think about what you want to do and then you plan for it. You can't just jump into a career and be the boss today. You have to decide what you want to do in the long run and learn what kind of education do I need, what kind of other preparation, and then I go into that career. And I thought, that sounds like really good advice. So I picked up the newspaper and looked in the want ads, and I saw that the highest paying job that was being advertised was a chemist. And so I decided at that moment that I would become a chemist.
Oh, this is a really economic-driven decision.
It was very economically driven. Mm-hmm.
And we'll get into this later on in the program, because now, Mary, you've founded your own company, and we'll get to that a little later on. But anyway, so there it was, chemistry, simply because that particular day you looked at the wanted ads, that was the highest salary.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
That's very interesting. Okay, let's get on to what your speciality is. Analytical chemistry. Just give our listener, why do we have this separate subdivision of chemistry called analytical chemistry?
Well, the purpose of analytical chemistry is to find out the composition of things all around you. And one example that I think everybody is familiar with is when you go to the doctor, if something's wrong with you, the doctor will have a medical test done. And that medical test is a good example of analytical chemistry in action. The doctor wants to find out what is it that's making you sick. And there's something in your blood or other biological fluid that will tell the doctor what it is that's wrong with you. And where that test comes from is that some analytical chemist figured out what it was that was related to the disease. And it's probably not just one person, but lots of different people doing research to determine what it is that's related to the disease that they can measure. And then one or more analytical chemists came up with the actual measurement that's made in the lab, worrying about, how practical it is, what sort of interferences that there could be that would lead them in the wrong direction potentially, and eventually get approval from the Food and Drug Administration for the test. And then also worry with a company about how to make it cost effective so that it doesn't cost $1,000 for the test, that it's reasonably inexpensive.
The only thing I would add to that for those, some people like myself who don't like going to the doctor, is that he'll give you these tests to show you're okay, not necessarily that you have a disease.
Yeah, that's true.
That's right.
That's a whole different topic.
Right. Doctors. Well, I mean, certainly that's you never feel better than when you come out of the doctor's office with all the blood tests and said, you know, negative, 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 and you suddenly realize, I'm in great shape.
Yeah, but if it's a good doctor, one of them comes out positive and he knows what medicine to give you,
right,
and then you get better.
Yeah.
Like strep throat, for example.
Or cholesterol, mm-hmm, is a common one for many people.
Tell us then, that sort of brief description, is that how your career developed? You started out by devising techniques for analyzing certain materials and then moving into more medically oriented? Or tell us briefly how you started your career and what you're doing specifically.
Well, I started out my career when I went to college. I had this idea that I was going to do exactly what the newspaper had called for, which is I'd get a degree in chemistry, and then I would go and get one of these nice, well-paying jobs in industry. And what happened then is after a few years of studying chemistry, I just loved it. I just thought it was the most interesting thing in the world. It's like being a modern-day explorer.
So you decided to go to an underpaying university because it was so interesting.
Yeah, actually, the science became more of a driver than the money. You know, once you get a certain amount of money and you can pay all your bills, it's your lifestyle that really matters.
Okay, you got your doctoral degree. And then what was it that you said, this is where I'm going to start my investigations?
The way I would put it is that I just loved learning, and so I didn't care about practicalities and applications when I first started out. And I think that's actually what I recommend for a young person. Just learn. Don't worry about how it's going to be used. When you get older, then you start worrying about the impact, how it's going to be used. And so I just purely did things that were interesting to me. And then after a period of time, I began to realize that at the university that I was at the time, that salaries weren't going up. And so then I left and got a job at a national lab and got a much higher salary. And what I learned at the national lab was that everybody around me was worrying about impact, how what you did affected what was happening on the front page of the newspaper. And
which
that was
national lab was that, Mary?
Lawrence Livermore National Lab.
All right.
That was the first time I ever saw the relationship between what I was doing and what was on the front page of the newspaper.
Wow.
And that was really a lot of fun.
I myself never seen that.
Yeah.
Nothing I've done except in social terms has got on the front page of a newspaper.
But it's really a thrill to realize that you're working with people that's making the news and that it's impacting things that everybody worries about. And so that was a lot of fun. And so ever after that, I was 30 years old when this happened, and ever after that, I've always worried about the impact of what I'm doing. It isn't just being an explorer and looking at things that nobody's ever seen
before. And that's
a
very important view that I agree with completely. But sometimes I would even think, you know, look, we're getting grants and we're paid to do this wonderful fundamental research, and we do have some obligation to work on the impact.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for young people just getting started, you really want to focus on the learning aspect, because that background is what you need later on to have impact. So I would tell young people, don't worry about impact right away. Worry about developing your skills, developing your interest and your enthusiasm, and then the impact will come later on. You'll get interested.
So in many universities, not this one, of course, but many universities you have attention between the ivory tower, people said impact is for somebody else, I'm just in my corner, and the people that do want to use their research for impact. Do you find that?
That's the way it used to be, but more and more today, it's hard to find somebody who doesn't worry about impact.
What were the areas that you were wanting to make an impact in? Let's get to some specific ideas that you created and say how you thought that was going to have an impact from your fundamental studies.
Yeah, my research now, I'm mainly interested in things like medical testing, because I've seen so many people whose lives have been disrupted by having cancer or having a close relative have cancer. And people would say, if only it had been caught earlier, this wouldn't have happened. And so what I'm interested in is developing earlier diagnostic tests for cancer so that you could, you know, the idea, this isn't my own idea, there are many people that have this idea, that you would go to the doctor as part of a checkup with no symptoms, give a blood sample, and they could find in that blood, say, very early pancreatic cancer, for example. And I give that as an example because once you find out you have pancreatic cancer,
its prognosis is pretty bad.
The cure rate is very, very low.
So are you specifically working on tests for pancreatic cancer or more general?
More general. Yeah, so we're working in academics. What you do is you look at a problem and then you step back and you ask what is limiting that. And then you do research on the limitation with the idea that it can be translated into an application. And so the limitation there is that your blood is very complex. There are lots of different things in your blood, in particular proteins. And really, it's probably going to be a protein or a set of proteins that is diagnostic for early cancer. And to detect proteins, the human genome, which was sequenced earlier in this decade, codes for about 30,000 proteins. And each of those proteins gets modified. There's something called post-translational modification. So after the genome creates the protein, the body changes it a little bit. It modifies it so that it does something a little differently. That's how your body has precise control over metabolism. And so that makes for about 100,000 or more different proteins in your blood. And so out of those 100,000, you need to try to detect those that are unusual from the cancer. And if the tumor is very small, there's very, very little of those unusual proteins. And so that is a problem that needs to be addressed by research. So that's what we work on, is how to find a needle in a huge, huge haystack.
Well, that's a good place for a break. You're listening to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Kinelli, Mary Wirth from Purdue University, talking about diagnostics and trying to separate needles in haystacks. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. When you think of jaundice, the liver probably comes to mind. Jaundice is when a person's skin and eyes become yellow.
It can mean the liver isn't doing its job of processing and getting rid of bilirubin, a byproduct of dead red blood cells. But in some cases, the pancreas is responsible.
We're talking about the head of the pancreas, where a host of processes important to digestion is located. You see, the liver produces bile for digesting fat, and it's stored in the gallbladder. That's also where bilirubin goes after the liver converts it to a form that the body can excrete.
As food leaves the stomach and heads to the small intestine, bile is also released to aid in digestion. To get there, bile, along with bilirubin, travels along the bile duct to the head of the pancreas. The pancreatic duct then joins food in the small intestine. Eventually, bilirubin will exit the body, giving our stool its dark color.
But when any part of that is blocked, then bilirubin starts to build up in the blood. The challenge is determining the cause of the blockage, a pancreatic tumor or gallstones, which can easily be removed.
Scientists have found a new marker to distinguish between them. The study measured levels of a molecule called VEGF in the bile. VEGF stands for vascular endothelial growth factor, which is a key regulator of blood vessel formation and what cancerous tumors need to grow.
The study found VEGF greater than half of 1/1,000,000 of a gram per milliliter indicates there's a cancer, and it's accurate in 93% of cases.
Screening someone's bile is easier and cheaper than current methods, which involve imaging. Being able to diagnose pancreatic cancer early is life-saving in and of itself.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Russ Kinelli, and Mary Wirth from Purdue, and we're talking about analytical chemistry and the ability to sort of use analytical chemistry nowadays as a diagnostic tool to tell us, are we well or are we going to get sick? So, Mary, going back to where we finished off then, you're looking for these errant proteins, proteins that shouldn't be there normally except that you've got some illness. Give us a particular example. Now, you don't go looking for these proteins to begin with. You're told by people in the biomedical area that these proteins will be produced, and then you're trying to find methodologies for detecting them.
Mm-hmm.
So how does that collaboration work?
Okay, so these proteins, people call these biomarkers, and there is a huge number of people who are doing what is called biomarker discovery. So again, when you go into the doctor for a medical test and they want to find out if you have strep throat, for example, there is something that's called a biomarker that they're looking for. And so I'm going to call these biomarkers instead of errant proteins now. And what limits right now the detection of biomarkers is the fact that they're so minute in concentration.
Are you talking about parts per trillion or even worse?
Even worse, right. Really, really tiny amounts.
It's bigger than the national debt.
Yeah, right.
It's
like trying to find a dollar in the national debt.
A recent visitor on Science Studio called cancer cells zombies. They should have self-destructed. So you're actually looking for these living dead markers there.
Yeah, the cancer cells do die, but not all of them die. And so the cancerous tumor keeps living. But as these tumors die, the proteins are secreted into the blood. And so it's these proteins that are shed by the dying cancer cells that you want to detect. So what we work on is the technology, new technology that will allow people to detect these at low concentrations.
You know, for most of us, even Russ and I, we're chemists, we use analytical techniques all the time. But one in a trillion, I mean, it's amazingly precise. How do you go about doing this now? What is your technique?
Well, to detect really tiny amounts is not actually that difficult. So there are things called antibodies that people use that bind minute amounts of proteins really tightly. And so as one example, the home pregnancy test, which you can buy in the drugstore, has a piece of paper that has antibodies on it for a hormone that's related to pregnancy. And it can detect those in urine and in very tiny amounts. And so it's not so much that it's that difficult to detect a tiny amount.
Well, that's because you found the specific antibody which the body would produce to.
Right.
But now you've got to do something with that. I mean, you've got to put some marker on there, a fluorescent dye or something, in order that the layperson can recognize that there's been a meeting of the antibody and the protein.
Once you know what biomarker you're looking for, you can create an antibody for it and make this test. The whole problem today is that you don't know what you're looking for. And so it's the biomarker discovery that's the problem today.
Mm-hmm.
How do you find out whether, you know, what the needle in the haystack looks like? It might be something, it might be a safety pin in the haystack. You've got to find out can you imagine you don't know what the needle looks like and you're supposed to be finding it in the haystack? So the first problem is, how do you sort through the haystack and try to find these things that are not pieces of hay? There's something unusual. And so we developed the technology for sorting out the hay in the haystack.
And what is the technology you're using?
The technology that we're developing is a new aspect of a field called chromatography. If you've ever put a piece of ink on paper and watched it spread, it can actually spread into different colors. And so that's a separation of the different pigments in the ink. And so there's a very well-developed field called chromatography, which uses the same principle, uses silica particles, a very high-tech form of sand, to do separations. Any medicine that you take has been characterized by chromatography to make sure that it doesn't have toxic impurities, and the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, demands that things be purified and analyzed by chromatography. So what we're doing is we're pushing chromatography to make it work 10 times better than it does today.
And that means a finer separation?
A finer separation.
I mean, how do you improve it?
Well, the best way to improve it is to make the sand particles more uniform in size and also to make them smaller. And so we're using sand particles that are 10 times smaller than what has been used
before.
Sounds
like material science.
It is material science. Yeah,
in fact,
it's today,
nanotechnology,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. Today, to make advances, you really need to be multidisciplinary.
Yeah.
So I'm a chemist, but I'm also a material scientist, and I talk to biologists all the time.
Okay, so then let's say you have a very finely graded material that you're happy with. Do you then take cancer cells from rats or blood, or how do you find the needles?
So the idea is that we develop this technology and we want to put it in the hands of lots of people. It's not going to be one person who discovers biomarkers. It's going to be thousands of people who discover biomarkers. And so what we do is we work on this technology and give it to as many people as we can so that as many biomarkers are discovered.
But you must
possible.
Have some nice examples of where all of a sudden you found a needle or somebody comes and says, look, I've used your technique for this and here it is. You must have some examples of that.
We're working on that. So we're working on the technology. When you do research, people always want you to be finished now if it's a good idea. And so it must be a good idea because you want me to be finished now and to be discovering the biomarkers.
The reason I'm asking this question is I think you're trying to commercialize this, right?
We'll commercialize it, yes.
Okay. And do you have a company to do this?
Yes, I have a company to do this.
Could you say what the name of the company is?
Yeah, the company, I started a company in Tucson called BioVidria, BioVidria.
Bioglass.
Yeah, basically,
like yeah. Right.
I picked
for
the
silica.
Name. Yeah, what we do is our silica particles are really, really tiny. And they're
so does
actually,
that mean, just for our audience then, you have these unique silica particles. Do you patent those?
We patent various aspects of the silica. So the silica particles themselves occur in nature, so you can't patent those. And they're easy to make. And so what we patent is the device that they're used in.
The use.
Why is the nanoparticle so important in this? How does that make a refinement in the separation?
If you have a lot of proteins and you're trying to separate them, the smaller the particles, the more proteins you can separate. It's the whole concept is miniaturization. If I make my particles smaller and smaller, then the little separated zones that come out are going to be smaller and smaller, narrower and narrower, so I can separate more proteins. And so that's the basic idea. So the particles that we're using are on the order. They're as small as, I don't know if this number is going to mean anything, but 150 nanometers. Which is almost 1,000 times smaller than the width of the human hair. It's mind-boggling. Even as a scientist, we throw around these numbers all the time, but it's very hard to picture that. They're really, really tiny.
Yeah, so I think the idea is that you get the resolution because the smaller the particle, the less of them can be absorbed. So you have a mixture of, on a larger particle, you have a mixture of the compounds, and a smaller particle, you may only get a few.
You mentioned that the small particles of your silica, the sand, if you like, occur naturally. But the materials that you use, you don't go and dig these up. I mean, this is not quite naturally where you can go to a coal mine or you can go to a zeolite resource. You have to manufacture these nanoparticle silica pieces.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Now, we could go dig these up. And they do occur in nature, and they're called opals. And what we do is
opal.
They're opals, right?
And my wife loves opal.
Yes, good. So,
but not ones that are 100 micron nanometers.
No, they are.
They got to be bigger than that.
Listen.
Well, the particles, remember the particles are hundreds of nanometers, but the actual opal is something that you can see and buy in the jewelry store.
Right.
And so if we were to go and dig up these opals, we could sell the opals for a lot more money than we could sell these chromatography columns. And so we would go into the jewelry business.
How do you make then artificial opal
exactly,
films?
Right.
How do you do that?
So we've read the geology literature and learned how they're made naturally, and we try to mimic those conditions and speed them up.
So you found a methodology to reproduce the geological process in the laboratory. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
Tell us how what you have to do.
All right. So if you purchase or make these particles, they're all the same in size. They're like billiard balls. And what Mother Nature has figured out accidentally, of course, is a way to take these little particles and stack them like billiard balls so they're really organized. And so they're evenly spaced. They're in what looks like a crystal lattice, perfectly ordered. And lots of people have worked with these in the laboratory and have gotten these to stack very nicely. What we've figured out is how to make them do this really fast. And if you can make them do this really fast, like in, say, 15 minutes, well, then you can make a commercial product. So the way that these have been done in the lab, it's taken a few days to make these things. And so we can now make them really fast, and that will allow us to have a commercial product. And we're patenting this. And since we haven't filed the patent,
okay.
I'm
you can't
not
talk
allowed
about it.
To disclose.
But I think there's something that needs to be said, dismissed. It's not just the size of the particle. It's how the particles are lined up in the film. That for an opal, for example, that's what gives the interference with light that you like. Okay, so it's the process of lining them up in a film, and they're all the same size. But it's also, we know from, you know, this is related to catalyst studies, that making them all the same size, the silica balls, is not so easy in itself.
They're close enough in size that we don't even see limitations to these right now. They're so close in size. They're within 10% of one another. You know, you bring up the idea of the wavelength of light. That's why opals are beautiful. The particle sizes are on the order of the wavelength of light. And what happens is you get these things called interference effects and diffraction effects. So you get these amazing light effects because they control how light behaves. And so you have all these pretty colors that depend on the size of the particles and on the angle of the particles.
So your opal, are they on a substrate or are they just packed all together in a column like a, you know, a layer of dirt in a glass tube? How do you actually use
the opal? We have two products. The first product has these spread out on a microscope slide. They're about 5 microns thick, so about a tenth of the width of the human hair. And so there's about 10 particle in the layer, something like that. And so it's an artificial opal that is just a very thin glaze on a surface. In fact, that's where we chose the name Biovidria, because vidriar is the Spanish word for glaze. Yeah. And so we're glazing a layer of opals on a microscope slide. And the purpose of that product is for something called protein microarrays, where I would take, say, a biomarker and spot it on a surface and see whether the right things bind to it to characterize whether it's a good biomarker. Our other product, we put these things into silica capillary columns. And so we coax these things into forming opals inside of very narrow columns. And they're beautiful. You look at them under the microscope and they look just like gem quality opals.
Could I, if I had the yours next to a conventional one, would it actually look opal-y?
It does. It looks just like an opal. The only thing is that we make them really tiny. Again, miniaturization is the key to looking for biomarkers. So the only difference is that ours you would have to look through under a microscope.
Okay, so it's not like a glass plate that you would use DNA on or something.
Oh, no, we have that as well.
And does that look attractive like an opal from when you view this microscope slide?
No, that doesn't.
Ah.
But the ones in the capillaries are gem-quality opals. So if you were going to wear these to a party, you would have to bring along a microscope for everybody to look through in order to see your
I just see you buy
opal.
Your wife or girlfriend one of these, and you say, well, here's the microscope. People have got to examine your
No, you project it onto the wall.
You started this company just very recently, I think, right? Just a couple of years ago?
Just a few years ago.
Right, and so you're at the takeoff period. What are your goals with respect to that?
Well, our goal is to have a series of products. And so our first product are these microscope slides that have the thin glaze of opals on them. We're introducing that into a market called the protein microarray market, where people do biomarker detection and validation. And then we're working now on a small business grant for our second product, which will be these capillaries that you use to actually separate the proteins, putting the haystack in and having the individual needles come out.
Hey, it's been a great program. And Russ, why don't you say a few words to wrap up?
Thanks to Mary Wirth for coming here in Science Studio and telling us about this fascinating idea. And thanks to our opal-like producer, Norma Martinez.
She's full of interference. Is that what you're saying? We'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
I'm Nomi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center El Paso and El Paso Children's Hospital are organizing the first ever El Paso Pediatric Colloquium. It takes place June 7th. The agenda includes a review of ethical dilemmas, clinical conundrums, and the use of simulation to address emergencies in the clinic setting. Read more at mcasynapse.org. Support for Synapse comes from the Kindred Hospital.